And welcome back to a very special episode of This Week on Channel 9. I'm Brian Keller.
I'm Dan Fernandez.
And I'm Martin Woodward.
Welcome back, Martin.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Always good to have you. It must mean it's MVP summit time. We're getting close to that, right?
Well, I heard a special rumor about a certain person having a birthday, so I thought I might as well come along and help celebrate.
And let's go to the slide.
Who's that?
Oh, a certain person.
Yes, let's go to the slide.
That was a professional link and everything.
Oh, that was horrible. So it's our fourth anniversary. We've been doing this for 4 years now.
Hard to believe. We've done 184 episodes, I believe. Wow. And if we were a syndicated TV show, we just made it further than the original Star Trek. which is cool.
Boom.
Just throwing it out there, Shatner. I'm just saying. And then I think we have some other stats as well.
Yeah, we've had 8.77 million downloads.
That's you. That's so, thanks, Mom.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, that's my auto-downloader.
Yes.
Nailed so if that was everybody, you know, if that was people, mm-hmm. we'd be bigger than Burundi.
Burundi.
Ooh,
wow.
Yeah.
And
like,
made it.
Ireland and Switzerland, bigger than Greater London in the UK.
Wow, okay. Fantastic.
So, and then if you were to take 8.77 million M&Ms, you could fill the whole studio, like a 200 cubic feet.
That's just awesome. Delicious.
Yes.
4 years of deliciousness.
And here's another stat for you. If we had a dollar bill for every download and laid out those dollar bills end to end, we could just about, from here, building 20, get to the outskirts of Vegas. The really awesome. Seedy outskirts of Vegas. So
how's that?
The dodgy.
The dodgy, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, awesome. I love it.
Cool.
That's great. Good numbers. So thank you to all of our
It's really all about you.
There.
So thank you all for supporting us and everybody, and certainly Greg Duncan, who's just such a big help on our show. We're just talking about how much we appreciate Greg.
And oddly enough, we actually referenced one of Greg's posts in the very first episode of This Week on Channel 9, even before we knew Greg.
Yeah.
And thanks also, we have to remember that Ian and Chadka helped name the show.
That's right. Shout outs to Chadka.
Yeah. Yeah. So thanks. We love you guys out there in Channel 9 land, and this is the reason we do it every week. So with that, let's jump into
news. So our first post is actually something near and dear to my heart, and that's the Kinect for Windows SDK V1 and the hardware. So now you can actually order the Kinect for Windows hardware, and that device is specifically for commercial applications. It includes a new mode called Near Mode that can actually get depth data a lot closer, 1.3 feet away, 0.4 meters away from... where you're putting the Kinect, which is kind of unheard of, as opposed to being almost double that distance before.
0.4 meters in American terms, what is that?
1.3 feet.
1.3 feet. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Good. Okay. I didn't just say the numbers. Okay. Good. And there's a lot of stuff going on. There are, for those of you who have been using the beta, a number of API changes, significant API changes that you're gonna have to do. Rob Relly has some really good posts on the breaking changes and details of the API changes. There is a library to help people migrate as well that does almost like a mapping from old API to new API. And more importantly, we launched our Kinect for Windows SDK Quick Start series. So that's everything from camera fundamentals to working with the depth sensor to doing skeletal tracking. Actually, I have like a picture of a 9 guy and have it track my head so it follows me around.
Nice.
And audio programming, so things like recording audio, how to do speech recognition, and how to do sound source localization so it can actually find the direction of sound.
That's so exciting. It's really cool, because I know a lot of people have already created some applications that they think will have great commercial use, but this is the first time that people can actually build a business around it, right?
Yeah, and certainly, you know, one of the fun ones that I have to say, since you're playing Skyrim, somebody built the Skyrim add-in for the PC version, so it's all voice commands, so like changing weapons, a really common thing, is just a voice command, or to take a potion, a voice command.
I thought was...
It's brilliant. You watch it and you're like, of course, that's a great way to use to play Skyrim.
That's awesome.
So can you use it with the Xbox hardware, or do you need the
The Xbox hardware we can absolutely use for development and test. It's when you're doing commercial applications and commercial applications are distributing, then you have to use the Kinect Redis, and that does require the Kinect hardware.
Okay.
So if you have a regular Xbox 360, you can run all of our samples and play with them. You will get a little thing in the output saying it's for development test based on your hardware.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome. Congratulations. I know that was a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So kudos to the team.
Yeah. And also this week here on campus in Redmond is the first ever, right, Going Native
Yes,
conference.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So what does it mean to go native?
You know, this is the conference really sort of celebrating C++. There's a number of things. They have Bjarne Strauss up, did the keynote this mm-hmm. morning, the inventor of the C++ language, and talking a lot about CX11 and some of the things to make, say, code more readable and some of the different ways to optimize, say, vector versus list, and really just taking a really interesting approach from sort of his perspective on C++. I thought that was really interesting. There was another session on parallel and bad things you can do with async. So how compilers are going to treat things, you know, whether you're going to get into a weird state where it looks like something would work, but it actually wouldn't, sort of like gotchas, if you will. Stephen Tay, I think STL, as Charles calls them, doing some talking about specific features in VC11. That they're going to be bringing and performance optimization, so a lot of cool stuff going on.
I'm sure my head would explode trying to figure out all this stuff. So I have mad props, you know, respect to anybody who's a like hardcore C++.
Oh, the coolest part was there was like somebody from Bungie there, like you just read their badge, you're like, hi. You guys are like alpha. Is it really warm? So kudos to Charles. And the big thing is all that content's not only streaming live, but will be available on demand.
Right, absolutely. That's cool. So this is another story. Basically, it's a set of guidance that came out around doing Windows Azure application debugging and troubleshooting. And it's kind of an evolving field. This is a paper by William Bellamy and other contributors as well. But, you know, they talk about the notion that, you know, Azure, the data center, is going to have something like 5 nines uptime or whatever that is, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you've architected your application to have that full uptime.
Uh-huh.
And so we've talked about this in the past, the Chaos Monkey that Netflix uses on top of AWS.
That.
The idea is that if I just start pulling random services, how is my application going to continue to behave? And so you need to think about that when you're moving to a cloud-based system like this, that sometimes, you know, one part of the service may be down and how do you fall back gracefully and troubleshoot that and figure out how to get it fixed and all that stuff. So I really like this set of guidance. You know, like I said, it's an evolving field and I hope to see a lot more of this.
Something we've learned a lot as we're building the Team Foundation service in the
cloud
is that we're, you know, you think there's going to be all this smoke and mirrors that magically keeps things available for you, and it's not at all. You know, you've got the service there, but you still have to code the smarts in to make your application make sure it responds well to things that happen.
So, it is reliable, knows when to restart.
Yeah, there's no
you
smoke
have the
and
right
mirrors.
Monitoring, everything.
Yeah.
Elastic scaling, everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, cool.
Yep.
So this was a post, you know, there's some great resources on the Windows Phone site in terms of getting started with developments and some good getting started guides. But this was a post from Bill Schmeiser, I think his name is, or
Sisma.
There we go. And it's just a roundup of lots of different resources externally that you can get hold of, like that you might need while putting your application together. So not getting started guides as much, but, you know, some, say, royalty-free music and some art and some different resources from all around the net.
Toolkits,
toolkits, all that sort of thing.
Uh-huh. A lot of cool stuff.
You go through it. It's an absolutely huge post. So there's some good stuff in there. So worth having a look at.
Nice.
Very cool. This post is actually Pete Brown talking about some of the new things in WPF4.5 and specifically around the Week Event Manager. And Pete talks about some of the things that you may not realize when you're just subscribing to events and you have somebody else subscribe to an event, and he goes through real world examples. Hey, let me just see what happens. Let me profile the memory and we'll see, you know, there are issues here because we're subscribing to events and we're never unsubscribing. So he talks about, you know, obviously you want to be able to unsubscribe events and make sure that you're unsubscribing, because, you know, there's a number of situations where people never unsubscribe from events. And you can imagine a Windows Phone application where that page stack is still alive and there's actually events firing. And we had, you know, our first app that we did, our t-shirt cannon, was doing exactly that. So we had to make sure that on navigation that we were actually unsubscribing from events while we were receiving stuff, so we wouldn't be, say, able to shoot while we're moving, that kind of thing.
Oh, right.
But it's really good things to keep in mind, and even just a walkthrough of how you can see that there's performance problems, and then specifically how to use the Week Event Manager as well.
I know I've mentioned this before, but every time I read Pete Brown's post, I just assume it's specific to Commodore 64. It's a lot more enjoyable for me to think about Pete just hammering out these posts, you know, all on a Commodore 64. So,
oh, that's great.
So an introduction to you, this agile development with Team Foundation Server.
Yeah,
what are these things all about?
Yeah, exactly. Team Foundation Server. Hey, here's the one where we try and kill Dan with TFS.
Oh, it's really interesting.
So Giles Davis is out of the UK. He's a good guy out of the UK. And he's talking through how to do agile development on top of Team Foundation Server 2010, and just explains about agile, how, you know, what all the different practices are, where they've come from, all the agile manifesto, and then how to actually implement some of those best practices on top of TFS 2010.
Cool. Agile process template, huh?
Yep. And Scrum, and there's two. Uh-huh. There's a Scrum process template too.
Does he go through the pros and cons of using one to the other?
It's not so much in this, but it's more just the general principles of Agile and how you can apply them into your organization.
Right.
And also the one of the problems with Agile is it's, you know, you can try and force people to use a process, but that doesn't work. You've got to, you know, people just won't accept it. You've got to bring people into the process and make people believe, otherwise, you know. You're just forcing them to check
enabling
boxes.
Enabling change.
Exactly.
And yeah, I just fire people.
Yeah, it doesn't happen. Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, sometimes you have to pick the right process for the team you have, too.
Right. That's true. We could spend a whole show talking about this. So next, I want to talk about the debugger canvas. So we've talked about debugger canvas in the past.
Martin was asking, what is debugger canvas? So why don't you take a step back and assume people don't know what debugger canvas
is. Imagine you're talking to some dumb Java guy.
So let's say you're debugging your application, uh-huh. right? And you...
Do people know Martin works in Java? He's
Consulting.
Okay, no, that's a good point.
I am that dumb Java guy.
just to make sure he's not...
Okay, yes.
This is not a war.
So what? How do you start debugging an application in Eclipse? Is it F5
I normally press the debug button.
So you hit the play button on your exactly. VCR, right? Uh-huh. And you're stepping through your application and you set your breakpoints and everything else. And you're generating these, you know, nested call stacks and calling out all over the place. Mm-hmm. Well, Debugger Canvas actually takes all that information and it visualizes it for you using the same tools that we shipped as part of the 2010 architecture tool.
Oh, all the DGML stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So then you can see, well, if I go back to the graphic here in the upper right, you can kind of make out that I've got my classes and all of these are instance variables. And so I'm calling into one versus the other. And so you can literally step through just like
somebody
you would.
Clicked a button mm-hmm. Or button first, you know, right. Said whether there was a new class. There cool. wasn't. So then it created it. And then the constructor fired.
Wow. Yeah.
The constructor calls its own child thing. And then it goes back. Oh. And then it goes here. And then you want to be able to see that value. Like it's visualizing everything that actually happened.
Right.
That'd be really handy for trying to diagnose thread, you know, when you're blocking on threads and things like that. And,
right. So anyway, they just released their 1.1 update.
Okay.
You know, not any super huge features in here, a lot of fit and finish work, but, I love this. And every time I show it to customers, they just, you know, drool over it. So, doesn't work for Eclipse though. Sorry.
Well, there we go.
Yeah.
But it is awesome and definitely something everybody should have.
That's right. Uh-huh.
So speaking of something everybody should have, the Gang of Four patterns, as you know them well.
Okay.
So again, Eric Gammer, who works for Microsoft in Zurich, he's one of the Gang of Four, and it's a bunch of architectural patterns. Giles Davis again, not to have too.
You know, a lot of people didn't know that Eric Gammer actually does work for Microsoft.
Oh, okay.
I know there was like a news story that he was coming over to Microsoft. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, he's a good guy. You know, he's nice to have him in Europe. Nice to have someone to chat to in Europe. But Giles did a great presentation at an event in December in Leeds. Black Marble ran it, who are a consultancy, do a lot of ALM work over in the UK. And he showed how to build a plugin into an extension into the architecture tooling so that you can drag and drop Gang of Four patterns into the architecture tooling, into the UML modeling tools and things like that.
That's awesome.
So it's really good. And not only does it, not only is it a useful thing,
right.
but it's got all the how to build it and all the source codes upon Copex as
right.
well.
So I have to admit, I'm not really a patterns guy. What's an example of a Gang of Four pattern?
Well, the original model view controller and things like that
sort
of came from some of those things.
So, factory pattern. So rather
factory's classic.
You're going to, are you familiar with that one? I'm not going to let you create stuff. Yeah. I'm going to do stuff and then handle that.
It's okay. Don't repeat yourself. It's all right. Is that one of theirs too, actually?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Awesome. See, I do know a thing or two about this.
Singleton.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. What'd you call me? Moving right along.
I'm not making any statements about your future dating potential. So this is that HTML5 webcam training. And I think one of the interesting things here is all the videos are now available. If you look through this thing, and this is actually Doris Chen did the series, but a lot of people have been looking at how to program using HTML5 and just getting an introductory level content. So one of the nice things is they have an introduction to CSS3 and to Canvas and SVG. So a lot of HTML5 seems to be kind of the hot thing. The nice thing is these are all available so that you can watch and content CSS, HTML5, and certainly Canvas and SVG. So people who aren't familiar with Canvas, that's where you're doing almost, for .NET developers, I explained, it's similar to, let's say, GDI, mm-hmm, where mm-hmm. it's an area where on 30 frames per second, I'm drawing and in these pixels, I'm putting them in this position via JavaScript.
Right.
SVG being probably more similar to XAML, in that I have a concept of, say, an ellipse. And in fact, some of the XAML primitives look exactly like mm-hmm. SVG. So if you have, you know, an ellipse as being the classic one for a circle.
What does SVG stand for?
Scalable vector graphics.
Okay, yeah. Got it.
So
cool.
So cool content.
Yep. Which brings us to
Picks of the Week!
So my pick of the week is... it actually starts with a story. So I was with Scott Hanselman over at CodeMash a few weeks ago, and Scott
who? I'm sorry.
Scott Hanselman.
Never heard of him.
Yeah. So this guy in the community does a couple things out of Portland, and he was talking about another device which shall remain nameless, which okay. he found an application that allows you to quickly generate a kind of a screensaver. So it's the lock screen for your phone. And it shows on it the, you know, if you find this phone, please email this person or call this person. There's a reward, right?
Yeah.
And so he said, I'm going to build an app for Windows Phone. Scott, previous to that, had never built an app for Windows Phone. Mm-hmm. And so,
he's not a XAML guy. He's a web guy.
Right, exactly. And he'll be the first to admit that. And so he sat down, and in 6 hours, he had gone from never writing an app for Windows Phone to having an application which he published to the marketplace.
Wow.
And I thought that was just a really great example. I mean, obviously, Scott's a great developer.
He knows a little bit about C#.
He knows a little bit about C#.
Absolutely.
But he was able to dig in. And speaking of great resources, he put together a really nice homepage for his application, like a web page that you can go and read about it.
Uh-huh.
And I said, wow, that looks beautiful. And he's like, well, you know, I'd love to take credit, but that's actually a free thing out on CodePlex. Yeah. And so anyway, you got to read this post if you're thinking about jumping into Windows Phone application development, because, you know, it's in 6 hours if you can build something like that. I think it really speaks to the platform.
Hard
and the tools.
Parts just having the good idea, no?
Exactly. So,
so my pick of the week is actually a Connect service, and this is what it does is, and this is actually a picture of me doing this, and this is screenshots from a Windows Phone emulator. Now, the cool part is what we've done is, and by we I mean Brian Peek. He exposed Connect, so you can either have it running as a console or as a Windows service, so that you can actually get Connect data anywhere, right? Huh. So it's exposed as sockets. So let's imagine, for example, I could, with our laptop, actually see the live stream and even hear the live stream of what's going on in my office. And because we can use color, depth, or skeleton data, I can, for example, know, like, hey, I'm seeing somebody's hand go a certain distance from, so I can literally say and have an app that sends a command to say, you know, if somebody's hand gets this close, I can monitor them, send me a text message, or even play a sound like, get off my computer.
So does it just, do you run it on the host machine on your PC,
and
it exposes a network port, and then you can connect that from
exactly. So we did our client libraries to make it really easy, so nobody has to know about sockets or anything else. It's just a client library that gives you, you choose the image format that you want, the color, the depth, and the dimensions, and then just serializable skeletal data.
Right.
And that's every 20 joints in their the position of those joints.
So one of my friends out in the Eclipse community, Jonas Felling from Eclipse Source, they're currently building a Java integration into Connect. They've written their own like console application that they wrote to receive events, and then they were doing out of process communication. So they could use the host part right. and connecting to the port from yeah. Java. Maybe
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. Wow. I mean, you can imagine for other phone platforms yeah. and other stuff too.
And are the APIs the same on when you're doing this remote experience as they are when you're doing a local connect experience or similar?
So one of the challenges there is it depends on what you're doing. So for phone, there's no connect SDK that I can install on the phone. So I'm just getting data. If I want to, for example, do more like API calls.
Right.
That has to be exposed on the service level. So the service okay. level is just saying, here's the images and here's the location. You may, for example, want to build other stuff that says, here's the commands I want to do back, but you have to do that on the service level.
That's awesome.
And the code's all up on CodePlex? Something?
Code's up on CodePlex. It ships with the phone and the WPF app, so you can do things. And we did some of this for the West Coast Customs car, which we'll talk about, but that's the cool part where we could actually, you know, get the live stream of audio and hear what people are saying around the car.
Cool.
And but we can't reveal too much.
Okay. Is that coming soon?
Can you
tell us when?
I don't know if I can yet.
All right.
I don't know if I can yet. Okay. Actually, you know what? I can because it's on their channel March 11th.
March 11th.
Is what they're Mark saying the on
it's
on
the
that
day.
Day
after my birthday. So
oh, yeah? Okay.
Yeah, that can be a nice little treat.
Nice. And finally, Martin, your pick of the week.
Yeah, so this might be a little bit nerdy, but the...
might be.
So Ashley's done... he's a bit of a pocket calculator freak, he self-admitted.
This is part three of the HP talk show. So science you are.
So I did a degree in physics. That was like... Well, I don't have a degree in computer science, as you might be able to tell. So my degree is in physics, so I am and not a very closet nerd. But this one is, it's an emulator for HP 35. You might think, oh yeah, well, first of all, what's HP 35? It's a really old school, one of the, I think it's the first, scientific calculator.
Okay.
It was scientific calculator.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was actually the first scientific calculator that ever went into space. It's, you know, from the sort of the space age era. And, it's one of those, you know, reverse Polish notation type calculators. It speaks Yoda. It's like, you know, three multiply four.
Yeah, like you have to put the order in incorrectly.
Yeah,
because some of the, I remember those.
So glad I don't know this stuff.
Yoda calculator. So anyway, but it's this HP 35 thing. And, you know, you could just obviously write kind of, you know, a reverse Polish notation kind of calculator application and in F#. I imagine that's ridiculously easy because it's, you know, it's good at that sort of thing. But what he's actually done is he's taken the bytecode of the ROM of the calculator, which is out there on the internet, and he's put it in as a string, the bytecode of the ROM from the calculator.
Wow.
The ROM from the calculator was scraped by somebody, like, with a microscope going through the ROM. Actually pulling out the individual bytes that had been burned. It was into three chips, and they reverse engineered the ROM by, you know, optically scanning.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
No.
With a microscope.
puts it into a big string. And then when you read his F#, it's just amazing because he takes the string and, you know, turns it into a byte array and then is loading the ROM into memory. And the F# program is actually running the ROM as if it's the, and then you can send, you know, sums into the HP 35 calculator ROM and it uses the bytecode of the ROM. And it was so, you know, you forget, like, we're just so lazy at coding now. It was, you know, it was, I think it was, I think it says
it's in the upper right there.
Yeah, 960 byte ROM image. So, you know, the whole ROM for an entire scientific calculator into 960
bytes.
That's
the craziest thing I've ever seen.
They didn't comment, right?
So. That's the bytecode from the calculator.
That's awesome.
Talk
about minification.
And even the emulator itself is like a, you know, 100 lines of code sort of thing to run the bytecode. So
that's awesome.
Good on Ashley. That's a really funny post.
All right. So we're going to cut you up there because you could talk all day about the HP35, just like Pete Brown could talk about Commodore 64. Uh-huh. So thanks for being on our show. Thanks for 4 wonderful years and hopefully more to come. And we will see you next week.
Thanks.